This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano. Do not adjust your set. Lembitopic here, just for a few days, standing in for my colleague Mark. But the song remains the same. We still tackle the big issues, the things that matter locally and globally. And we're discussing this evening the obvious tensions between Israel and Iran. Maybe that's a euphemism. Maybe tensions isn't enough of a word. But from a United States perspective, to an extent, and to an extent from a UK perspective, do keep your calls and comments coming. I've just been speaking to Dr. Waleed Faris, who is well-versed in the subject, an author of 15 books, and a former advisor to President Donald Trump, who says he would go back and work for Donald Trump again if invited to do so on these issues. Let me tell you that we've got John Hulsman coming on next. He is going to be talking about a similar issue, but from a slightly different perspective. He's the author of a fascinating book called The Last Best Hope, A History of American Realism. And he'll be talking about why a war between Israel and Iran isn't to everyone's benefit, perhaps to no one's benefit. Now, I want to juxtapose what we've heard from Dr. Faris with what Mr. Hulsman says, because he might say or nuance it differently and say, actually, there aren't any winners at all. Dr. Faris was saying that there was a big vested interest in having an Iranian deal between the United States and Iran in the past. I want to put that question to John and see what he thinks too. Do keep your calls and comments coming. As much as I can, I'll read them out as well. We're always very pushed for time because we get in deep and really dig down with the guests, but I'll do my best to put your questions, your comments, your criticisms, and your praise to the guests as well. A few comments here, and then I want to raise another subject that's been annoying me today in British politics. First of all, Holly says, I think the smoking comments were funny, Lambert. Well, I wasn't really trying to make you laugh, Holly, about Iran and Israel. There are jokes I know about them, but I can't repeat them on air. The question about an incident in Syria, Holly points out, they killed people, and it's not acceptable. And El Cid says, well, according to Lord King Cameron, which is a response to the question, if Israel took out a UK diplomatic base, would we do nothing? That's Holly's question. That's a really good point, actually. If, let's say, Israel did kill the high command of the British Army, what would we do to respond? That's an interesting question. Benghazi Dave, that's what Holly calls him. She actually calls him something stronger as well, which I can't read out just at the moment, but I can read this out. She describes him as a waffling joker and a dangerous idiot. He was the prime minister who said he'd stay in office even if he lost a Brexit referendum, and then resigned as soon as he lost the Brexit referendum. I do remember that. Lo and behold, the unsinkable Dave Cameron comes back in a different role. A couple more here. Donna 29. Has now deleted the message. I did read it before, but I can't remember it now. I just remembered it was worthy. Holly says, I haven't got enough space for all of these books. Yeah, well, Dr. Faris has written 15 of them. Just take your time going through. Good show, says Huevo. Thank you very much indeed. I hope you like the service. I've got a very high bar to meet on Unleashed. Mark Moreno's made this his own space. It's an honor to be here. Holly says, we need more analysis from Tony Gosling. Fair enough. Noted by me and the production team. We'll see what we can do for you, but it won't be today. And just one more. Holly says, this is all to no one's benefit, just the war pigs. I find your views something I relate to. I never saw the benefit of war. Probably the single most important thing I did when I was a British Member of Parliament was help to broker a peace in Northern Ireland, a very troubled part of the United Kingdom for, oh, really centuries. But now living in a kind of peace which never was existent in my childhood days when I grew up in Belfast, which was the regional capital there. Now, before we go to my next guest, I want to highlight something else which has been developing. If you're in the United Kingdom or in Europe, you may have seen that the National Conservatism Conference being held in Brussels was attempted to be shut down by the police because it was too right-wing and likely to stir up public disorder. Now, this is a breaking story today. One of my friends, Nigel Farage, was there doing a talk. Somebody else I know, Suella Braverman, was also there. Well, here's the story, and I raise this on vaguely the same lines of concern that I raised my dissent in relation to the British attempt at banning smoking for everybody who's 15 years old and younger forever in the UK. A crazy, crazy policy, which basically means that you carry that cross, the desire to smoke, for the rest of your life without having the permission to buy those cigarettes in this country. As I said before, that leads to the unintended consequence of a massive contraband environment and people in their 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s going abroad and buying all their cigarettes there and then coming back and doing whatever they want to do with them here, because apparently it's not illegal to smoke. It's just illegal to buy the cigarettes. Very, very strange big mess that is. Now, this is what I'm concerned about. This National Conservatism Conference was inhabited by people I know well. Moderate people with strong right-wing views. Nigel Farage, essentially the architect of the victory in the Brexit referendum, was there. He was on the stage when the police came in, apparently attempting to shut down the event. And all this is because of a socialist mayor for the neighborhood who came to the view that these were unsavory and unwelcome people collaborating to bring down the good nature of the state in which they were welcomed. Not really welcome, because this, I think, was their third attempt at a venue, the other two being shut down as well. And the police come in and they take a look at the hundreds of people there and they change their strategy. Instead of shutting down the event, they reach a compromise of their own doing. They say, we're not going to let anybody else in. And if you come out, you're not getting in again either. What a strange thing to do. And let me emphasize the reason for this. Because the socialist mayor came to the view that these people were distilling some kind of horrible hate culture that those present in this right-wing event were exporting the politics of extremism and intolerance, presumably across Europe and the world. Now, once again, I've got a number of comments to make about this. First of all, because I know the people, not all of them, but I know a sample of them, a significant sample of them, the accusations against those individuals, at least, are, to quote Nigel Farage, cobblers, which, for those who are not familiar with that not rude slang in the UK, it means utter and total rubbish. My perception is, since they had members of royal families there, they had prime ministers there, they had senior politicians from across Europe and beyond. Those people were there to plan an ideology that they believe in, they share in, to hone a narrative for the right wing. And that I don't think is a crime. The socialist mayor insisted on saying they were spreading homophobia and opposing abortion. My next point is this. Even if they were talking about gender politics and abortion policies, why shouldn't they? In a free country, or in this case, in a free Europe, a Europe liberated from a totalitarian regime, I would point out, in the Second World War, in that free Europe, you should be able to debate the subjects that you want to. You shouldn't be silenced by a socialist mayor who simply didn't like the cut of the suits and the policies of the people in the neighborhood. Which leads me to my next point. If you follow this to its logical conclusion, then trumped up mayors in localities in Europe have the right to shut down any debate that doesn't fit their own ideology. What a strange arrangement. In what world is it reasonable to silence debate rather than having one? If this mayor thought that his arguments were stronger than those of the Conservative Conference, why didn't he go along and convince them? Why didn't he enter this unquestionably peaceful assembly and say, well, let me just clarify to you why your right-wing agenda is incorrect and why my socialist agenda is the right one? But instead, we have this ridiculous situation where the whole thing was shut down, at least in terms of entry and exit. The thing did actually carry on. And indeed, I'm just quoting now, Alexander De Croo, the Belgian prime minister, in other words, the prime minister of the country where all this palaver happened, also said the shutting down of the conference was unacceptable. Unacceptable. I agree. Now, I'm going to name the local mayor. Emir Kir, who opposed the conference, said that while municipal autonomy was a cornerstone of Belgian democracy, it could never overrule the Belgian constitution guaranteeing the freedom of speech, according to the prime minister. So the prime minister of Belgium is in direct opposition to what this local mayor did. And it's worse than that, actually. To his great credit, by the way, the prime minister actually said banning political meetings is unconstitutional, full stop. That leads me to my next point. By what authority did he do this? How did he get the police to shut down an event, which you may not agree with if you're not right wing, but you certainly should respect? Let me add all that together, because it seems to me this evening is a second example of totalitarianism writ large. Earlier on, I was talking about the prevention of a pleasurable activity for those who smoke, even if it may not be good for your health, by a rule which means that no one 15 years or younger is ever going to be allowed to buy tobacco in the UK. Now we're talking about a mayor in a locality, in a country where the prime minister doesn't agree with what he did, attempting to shut down a right-leaning debate. Now, according to Nigel Farage, there were speakers from organizations from countries where, in 9 cases, they will get the largest popular vote in those European countries. Well, all I can tell you is this is why people don't trust the kind of socialism that this mayor has put forward. Now, perhaps it was just his interpretation, but whatever the reason, I would suggest that we've now got a situation where this man has the explaining to do. This mayor has to face up to the fact that, presumably having been democratically elected, he doesn't want other democratically elected people and democratic parties to have the space in his area. This puts a stain not only on this man's mayorship, but also it's reputationally damaging for Belgium. I tend to think of Belgium as a fairly tolerant place. I've enjoyed my visits there every time. And on the whole, I think there's a leniency in the Netherlands, which is enviable. For example, they have a much more liberal attitude towards what you might say is drugs policy. But when you see rubbish like this going on, you begin to wonder, where will all this end? I made a prediction in my first hour that there would be the law of unintended consequences when we try to ban smoking for everybody who's 15 years and younger in the UK. Here's my second prediction. What we see here is a small-time, fairly quiet conference now being splashed across the newspapers of Europe and, to a lesser extent, across the planet in objection to the behavior of this small-time authoritarian who wanted to silence people with whom he didn't agree. As one of the organizers of this conference said, that's a National Conservatism conference, you couldn't buy this kind of publicity. I've chosen this as my story to share with you, dear viewer, because I want the conference to get coverage too. Regardless of the content of the debates they have there, I absolutely support and defend their right to have those debates. This is a classic example, if ever there was one, of unintended consequences. And if it was a football game, I would say, local socialist mayor 0, National Conservatism Conference 1. All of that is my view. You may have a different one. Please feel free to share it in the chat. And there are some comments there. I'll come back to them in just a minute after the break. Also, after the break, we've got my next guest, John Hulsman. He is a fascinating fellow with his own particular brand of interpretation about what's been going on with Iran. And I think what he says will follow very naturally with a different flavor from what we heard from my first guest, Dr. Walid Faris. All of that here on the Mark Morano Show Unleashed, where I'm standing in for him. I'm Len Bitopic. This is TNT. We'll see you in a minute.
The facts, no spin or agenda.
Not enough with the lies, we need the facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Eggs. You can fry them, scramble them, poach them, boil them, or race them on a spoon. But uncooked eggs can be a risk for food poisoning. To be safe, avoid buying dirty or cracked eggs. Always wash your hands after handling eggs. And if you're concerned, pregnant, elderly, or have a poor immune system, make sure you cook eggs until the yolk starts to firm. Or look for new pasteurized eggs. For excellent eggs, handle them safely.
Are we on the air?
Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
On the air 24/7. Your news talk giant, TNT.
This is Unleashed, Mark Morano's show with me, Len Bitopic, just standing in for a couple of days while he's away. But the song remains the same, as I said before. And today we're focusing on the Israeli-Iran situation with a US-UK perspective. Joining me now, somebody from who's in neither the US nor the UK, but in the beautiful city of Milan, the most fashionable place in Europe, in my view. It's John Hulsman. Thanks for joining us, and I like your suit.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I have a lot of suits to choose from here, so I'm lucky.
Where do you come from originally?
I come from the States, from Ohio. I worked in D.C. for about 10 years at various think tanks. I'm a life member of the Council on Foreign Relations, made man in mafia terms to talk about this very stuff.
I used to work for a massive company. You can guess which one it was when I say in Cincinnati. And we used to sell a lot of soap powder. It was a great job. I became very fond of Ohio then. And my favorite aircraft museum in the world is the Dayton, Ohio Air Force Base.
Wright-Patterson. Yeah, isn't that amazing? No, it's a great thing. You learn everything about the Wright brothers and you dream to look in the air again. No, it's a fantastic museum.
And my favorite ever aircraft, though I probably wouldn't have wanted to fly in it, was the XB-70, the Valkyrie, which when you get close, it's sort of banged together the way you think the Titanic would have looked when you were close, with rivets and so on. But it used to do 2,190 miles per hour. So I envy you for coming from a place for such a great aircraft museum. Your biography is quite remarkable. President of and managing part of John C. Hulsman Enterprises, which is understandable, it's your business. Prominent global political risk consulting firm. That sounds fascinating. I'll come back to that in a minute. And a senior consultant for City AM, which is a big, big paper in the City of London. And you do macroeconomics. I studied economics at the University of Bristol for a while, but decided it was a pseudoscience rather than a proper science or even a social science. So I gave up on that. And then, as you say, you've had a lot of experience on the Hill. If you were to put all that together, what would you say your defining characteristics are in terms of your political motivations? Is it international politics? Is it risk management or something else?
Well, it's not one. I mean, our selling point, my selling point, is that there are very few people who do politics and political analysis as well as I do. There are very few people who do macro as well as I do. There are very few who do military. There's almost nobody who can put the three together and say, this is what the pointillist painting looks like. If you can have a holistic picture of what goes on, if you know some economics, some politics, and some military wherewithal, then you got yourself a ball game. And that's what we do. We provide a holistic picture for our clients. We make prediction calls. And unlike many of the snake oil salesmen who are in my business, our call rates at about 80%. We called Brexit. We called Russia's invasion. Within 2 days, we called the last presidential race down to a 50-50 Senate. Judges by our results. The great thing about the modern world is the internet. There's a date and a time and a prediction. And don't listen to people, whatever their politics, who are wrong.
I love that. I bet you've said it before, and I bet you've got the gig when you said that before, because if I was looking for someone to quote a line from RoboCop, I'd buy that for a dollar. I take it. Why are you in Milan, by the way? Why do you live there or work there?
I live in Milan because we're a global company. And of course, I spend most of our clients are in London and New York and Washington. And so Washington's like being in high school. If you don't show up every day or other, they forget that you're not dating the cheerleader. You're in trouble. So we go home constantly to remind them of my existence. We go to New York to make money. And I love London. It's my favorite city in the world, actually, speaking of cities. I love writing for City AM. I've done that on and off now for about 15 years. And I went to university in St. Andrews. And so I have that background. I really, really do enjoy. But we needed a place in Europe, and I fell in love with a woman from Milan. And so why not live, as you say, in this wonderful, fashionable city where they still do know how to live life? I give them that. That I worked in Washington, but I'm a much better person in Europe.
It's all relative, isn't it? Yeah.
That certainly is.
I do find going to Washington, Washington is the same as oysters. It's all right, but not every day. Your book has got a tremendous title, and we'll go from this to asking some pretty deep questions. You've called it The Last Best Hope, A History of American Realism. Well, it does sound quite ominous. Why the title, and what do you tell us in that book?
It was ominous, and I wanted to say something positive. I it's so easy to say the two groups that have been dominating American foreign policy for most of my working adult life have both been awful at it, god awful at it. We have the neocons on the right who want to intervene everywhere all the time, all at once, who shoot first and ask questions later, and then serenely act like they didn't just destroy Iraq, Afghanistan, America's Middle East policy, spend $1 trillion and indirectly lead to the rise of ISIS, but they want to get a new job at The Atlantic or be Robert Kagan and be promoted, or be John Bolton and be promoted incredibly again to be national security advisor. At least the Kennedy guys had the good sense to drink themselves to death after Vietnam. You know, that there hasn't been a Republican meritocratic reckoning with the neocons, and there really should be. One of the best things Donald Trump has done is to kick them out of the party. And so this is the chance we have in the Republican Party to regain sanity. And of course, on the left, we see the Wilsonians who've gone left of Trotsky in their views of things. This is not commented on enough in Europe, but they talk a great deal about the Americans moving to the right, far less about the Democrats moving to the left. And indeed, some of the heroes in our book are good old-fashioned Democratic cold warriors, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Jack Kennedy. These are tough guys that, frankly, I would be happy to vote for in old conditions. And it shows you how far to the left the Democrats have gone, that Obama's now seen as on the right in his party. That's an incredible fact, but a true one. Bill Clinton is beyond the pale, but Barack Obama's on the right of his party, and they've all bought into this Wilsonian fairy tale where they believe for 20 years we can bring the Iranians in from the cold, that the goal in the Middle East is to bring the Iranians in from the cold, and then there'll be five great powers in the Middle East, and we can pivot to Asia, and everything will be fine. The lion will lie down with the lamb, and we don't need to worry about the revolutionary character of the Iranian regime. We'll just ignore that fact, and in fact, we'll give them billions back so they can incite acts of terror to upend the region. And this lunatic policy coupled with the neocons, made me want to write a book about when we were better. To quote the Beatles, I wanted to get back. Let's just be a band. We don't need all the tricks. Let's just play together again. And let's remember what brought America to the dance, which is realism. From George Washington, there's a chapter, through Lincoln, through defeating Woodrow Wilson's attempt to join the League of Nations, through FDR getting the Americans ready for World War II, from Nixon managing to best Mao, the Ted Bundy of modern international relations, and use Mao to win success in the Cold War, to Ronald Reagan and the shining city on the hill. I wanted to tell good stories about America and say to everyone, things are ominous, but we've been in worse shape before. And if we use realism, we'll come out of this in better shape now.
I'd vote for you for president on the basis of what you've just said. I haven't got a vote though. A couple of thoughts there. On the Trotsky point, I once beat a chap called Simon Pottinger. My surname's Opik. And I beat a guy called Simon Pottinger, who was a Trotskyist. And some smart aleck put in the paper, it's amazing how history repeats itself. Trotsky was beaten by an ice pick. Potty was beaten by an Opik. So I'll have to see what you said about it. I thought it was clever at the time. The second one is, I've noticed that the current Democrats seem to make Bernie Saunders seem like a moderate. He doesn't seem like he's an outlier anymore, which is kind of an interesting thing.
He's not. The party has moved to him. I mean, he's the grand old man of the party, not Bill Clinton, not Barack Obama. It's Bernie Sanders who's moving things around. That's why he's so quiet. He's getting what he wants. He's good tactically, and he's smart enough to shut up as he's getting what he wants. Why in the world would you intervene when they spent money after COVID like a drunken sailor? You got everything you wanted in the terribly named Inflation Reduction Act. Talk about Orwellian dystopia. The Inflation Reduction Act, which certainly did not reduce inflation. I think that's a kind thing to say. And when people say, I love like Paul Krugman, again, the idea that this man is given a lemonade stand, let alone a column in the New York Times, is beyond comprehension. He won the Nobel Prize. And I remember saying, well, yes, of course he did. I mean, a bunch of social democrats in Sweden gave a social Democrat in America an award. I mean, that's all that happened here. This is a guy who can't figure out that average Americans know that under Joe Biden, prices have gone up. The accumulated rate of inflation has gone up more than anyone in the last century except Jimmy Carter. And we all know what happened to him. And so you can say the rate of inflation has slowed to 3%, but everybody remembers that you can't buy a Happy Meal at McDonald's now for under $20. And the reason for that is the Inflation Reduction Act and the years when it was 8, 10, 12%. They let the genie out of the bottle that Reagan and Volcker had corked for 40 years, and now they're paying the price. So I wanted to write about people who didn't say, always intervene, never intervene. It's not a faucet. The answer realists have is it depends. It depends on American national interest, that American foreign policy should be run for the American people. That seems obvious, and yet that's not what's been going on for the last 40 years. The neocons, in line with Robespierre, and they are similar to Robespierre, as never let a good fact get in the way of their theory. Everything that went wrong, they just said we should have intervened more. We should have stayed longer. We should have spent more money. And indeed, that's what they're going to say about Ukraine now, by the way. If only we'd given them another $100 billion, everything would have been fine. That's always their answer. They don't look at, shall I run the list? Afghanistan, Iraq, Bosnia, Somalia, Kosovo, let's run the Haiti is one of my personal favorites, Haiti, where we've intervened 19 times and demonstrably to no effect. I'm being kind. The reality is that these people have spent $1 trillion in Iraq, destroyed the only countervailing force to Iran, led to the rise of ISIS, and somehow all got promoted. I don't think that's good in a republic when that happens. I naively think we should promote people who get things right and are not incredibly catastrophically wrong. And then when they say, trust me about Ukraine, perhaps we shouldn't.
Which makes me ask rhetorically, maybe if they put a bit more money into it, they could rerun Vietnam as well. But just leave that for the side for now. In terms of where you stand, I can guess the answer to an extent. How do you think Joe Biden's doing in terms of his relations with Israel and the Iranian situation?
Well, the first thing that the poor Biden, you know, the joke in Washington, and Washington, as you say, it's a nice place to visit, but I'm happy I haven't had to live there for a while, though I may go back if the conditions are right, but that would only be to help the country. And then I'd leave as fast as I could. But one of the things that people say is Joe Biden is really interested in a two-state solution. Those two states are Michigan and Wisconsin. Because in those two states are Arab Americans who can sink his election campaign. So for Biden, the two-state solution is Michigan and Wisconsin. So Biden, in typical Democratic Wilsonian fashion, is trying to be all things to all men. He's trying to be pro-Arab enough that he keeps these folks voting for him in Michigan, where he's down about 4 points to Donald Trump, and in Wisconsin, which is too close to call. And yet he's trying not to alienate the Israeli lobby in the United States at the same time, which skews Democratic overwhelmingly. But of course, by trying to be all things to all men, you end up being nothing to anybody. I got to know Lady Thatcher late in her life through various things I did. And one of the things I loved about her was that she said, look, always have a view. And if you have a view, the advantage will be that in having a view, you'll win over a third of the people. You'll lose a third, but they'll respect you. And then all you have to do is win over that middle third. That's a lot easier than trying to be all things to everyone and you end up being nothing to anyone. And that's the danger for Joe Biden. He's managed to alienate literally everyone pursuing his two-state solution, those two states being, again, Michigan and Wisconsin.
Hi, I'm Susan Lucci. I never thought about heart disease until I had my own heart event. At first, like so many other women out there, I ignored my symptoms. A slight pressure on my chest, shortness of breath. I thought, I don't have time to be sick. I had a 90% blockage in my main artery and a 75% blockage in the adjacent artery. I received two stents in my arteries. Stents developed through research funded by the American Heart Association. Those stents saved my life. I'm so grateful to the American Heart Association. Their research helped save my life. I can enjoy life with my children, my grandchildren, and my friends. Please, listen to your heart. The only reason I'm here today is because I did. Learn more about the American Heart Association's life-saving work at helpheart.org.
People might tell you that Lyme doesn't kill people, but we are losing people. People disappear from their lives.
One of the scariest things that I had to deal with was memory loss. Not just like I don't remember what I did last week, but like I forgot all the words to my own songs. I remember going to my primary care physician and he was like, you are 100% healthy, there's nothing wrong with you. And my response was, that's impossible, I'm dying.
I wasn't working. I had all of these hospital bills. We had to move out of our home and move into my parents' basement.
I just wish I could have truly been present in those big moments, you know, when she took her first steps or, you know, her first day of preschool. Lyme is such a thief and it goes undetected because no one is looking for it.
For more information and prevention tips, go to projectlyme.org.
Examining the issues. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed, Mark Morano's show with me, Lem Potopic, standing in just for a few days. Sorry, we seem to have a quick technical problem. I blame one of two people here, John. It's either Mark Morano himself, because he's jealous because I got you on the show, or it's Joe Biden. But would he have the nous to do that? I don't think so.
No, it's just it's the dark people around him, though. I think that's it. Biden doesn't know it's being done in his name.
Well, anyway, they can run, but they can't hide. And you were saying something very fascinating, actually, just before the break. Essentially, what I'm getting from you here is that the Biden administration is drifting. You haven't used that word, but that it's drifting, and it doesn't really have anything like the gravitas of previous Democrats, some of whom you said you'd vote for, and you think they've just gone right off to the left. And as you say, with inflation, where they seem to be saying the rate of increase in inflation is increasing at a lower rate, more or less, or something like that.
Yeah. Which, although that's wonderful for Paul Krugman, for the average person trying to go out for a meal with their family and having sticker shock because they remember pre-COVID prices, that's what he can't get away from. They've gotten him, they're begging him and the staff, and everyone in town knows it, to stop calling it Bidenomics, because, you know, mentioning it, bringing up that you're responsible for it, it's not a good look, as the PR people would say. And so he's just about stopping, though every once in a while there's a gaffe and it leaps out. He can't understand why people aren't thrilled with this inflationary era. And again, in the last 100 years, it's the second highest rate of increase in price, only to Jimmy Carter and the stagflation of the 1970s. And that's really where we are. You know this from DC, that the first overwhelming job of any political person in DC is re-election. That's the number one focus. Then second, domestic politics. And then the ugly stepdaughter, the Cinderella way down the line, is foreign policy. But foreign policy is coming back to bite him in a way that isn't normal, because they made these assumptions and then they were wrong. They assumed that after 2014, the Russians were not seriously going to invade Ukraine. They assumed that the Iranians weren't going to, you know, could be brought in from the cold, and then you'd have Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, and Egypt, five great powers, a balance of power in the Middle East. You could pivot to Asia. All the assumptions turned out to be fairy tales, because the problem with the left and with Wilsonians is they believe in a world that doesn't exist. As we say in The Last Best Hope, we compare Wilsonianism to a bird riding on the rhino. If you talk about international law and the international community, you're the bird. You may think you're driving the rhino, but you're not. What's driving the rhino is American national interests, is sovereignty, is states trying to get the better of each other. This has been true since Athens and Sparta, and it remains true today. And wishing away the history of the world doesn't make it so. And we see that wishing away, Iran has its own national interests that don't go along with what Biden might like. And we see this coming to get them. And so now they're in a flat panic because they're losing the election. In five of the six swing states, they're down. If the election were held today, Real Clear Politics say Trump would win 293 electoral votes, well above the 270. And this is driving literally everything they're doing.
So in your judgment, I've been told previously by actually Ed Martin, who was on at the weekend, that there are only six states. Well, he said seven states that matter. Is that true? All the other states pretty much do the same thing every time.
We could call right now the dirty secret in political risk. And yes, getting 50-50 in the Senate, I was sweating blood that night. It was, you know, that's a call that we got it exactly right. But you could call 44 of them right now. I mean, literally what's in play are Arizona, Nevada, North Carolina, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, those seven states. That's it. We can call the other 43 and we would be right 95 out of 100 times in each of those states. Massachusetts will overwhelmingly vote for the Democrats. So will New York. So will California. Texas will vote for the Republicans. So will most of the Deep South, the Plain States. Ohio's now solidly Republican. You can whittle the board down to those seven. All the attention is on those seven. And right today, Trump is ahead by beyond the margin of error, 3 points in five of them. Two are too close to call, which is Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. So Biden's losing. It doesn't matter what the national vote average is. It matters what the state votes are. And Biden is losing. And this is dogging literally every single thing he's doing. And so when he looks at the Iran conflict, he doesn't see what a statesman would, what FDR would have, or what Kennedy, the Kennedy brothers would have. What he looks at is he says, oh my gosh, how is this going to affect me in two of those states that matter, Michigan and Wisconsin, which have large Arab American communities. Also, by the way, another state that might just enter be the eighth state is Minnesota. A lot of Arab Americans and Muslims in Minnesota that vote in a block. And so that this could indeed affect the outcome in a very close race. And these margins are very narrow. And so he looks at this from a domestic political point of view, which, of course, isn't good for the American national interest. What he's doing may be good for Joe Biden, but he's stopping to think that Israel has a special relationship with the United States, that it's been a good and loyal ally, that we get an awful lot out of that relationship as they do out of us, like any good relationship, and that throwing them to the wolves and saying, and it reminds me of World War II, nobody would have said, gee, stop bombing German cities. You know, we should be nice to the poor German people there after what happened on October 7th. To expect Israel to do that is otherworldly.
So let's think about this. We've gone quite the discursive route to get to this. But let's think about it, because your book is really relevant to this. You've got Israel, clearly bankrolled by the United States primarily, a little bit by UK, but mainly by US. Then we've got Iran, which has been doing the hokey-cokey with America over the last decade or two, and clearly a regional superpower. What should, before we discuss what will happen, what should happen? What should a smart US president do, starting from where we are, not from 10 years ago, but from now, today?
That's the right question. That's the policy question, exactly. And what we should do is build on what Donald Trump did, and he did a couple things right. He said, that's exactly the wrong way to look about it. Iran is a revolutionary power. It's not like the other states we mentioned, Egypt or Turkey or Saudi Arabia or Israel. It wants to upend the order of the Middle East, the stability of that order, and create an order dominated by Iran. It doesn't want a balance of power with the others. It wants to dominate the region. So it's not just one of a series. It's different. It's a revolutionary power. So you don't bring it in from the cold. You put it into the freezer. You use the other powers, all of which are closer to the United States and the West than they are to our enemies. And you get them in an alliance, meaning the Saudis, the Turks, the Egyptians, and the Israelis. And you keep the Iranians in a deep freeze. And then you have a stable order that is broadly pro-Western, broadly one that we can live with, broadly stable, broadly does the things that we need it to do. And then you pivot to the Indo-Pacific, where all the future risk and all the future reward are. That's the name of the game. But that's what you do now. You build on what Donald Trump did. You ignore the Palestinian issue as the central issue in the region. And you see instead Iranian adventurism as the central issue in the region. You unite through an alliance these other countries together, and then you've got yourself a ball game.
Okay, now that sounds very plausible. It doesn't sound to me that you have any expectation that Biden's administration will make that 30 or 40 degree course correction.
No, I don't think they will, but the great thing about people who are wrong is if you get it's, you know, it's back to my good St. Andrews education. Fruit of the poisonous tree. If your premises are all wrong, the fruits don't eat the fruit. It's poison. And they will continue to do things wrong. They will continue to muddle along. But fortunately, both the Israelis and indeed the Iranians have a sense of their own interests and survival. And so if we can just limp along, Donald Trump comes back and pushes the Abraham Accords, which had begun this process where Israel now had relations with Sudan, with Morocco, with the Gulf states, both Bahrain and UAE for the first time recognized Israel. That would never have happened without the Saudis nodding that through. The Saudis are the dominant force on the Arabian Peninsula. So you build on what's already there under Trump and you add the Saudis into that mix, and you've then really come a long way toward getting to what we're talking about. And what needs to happen is we need a course correction. In other words, we need Jeffersonian election.
Holly's listening intently to what you're saying, and I'm reading from TNT Radio live chat here, who says, okay then, John, who's really calling the shots? It isn't Sleepy Joe.
No, I mean, and this is where I think it's really Obama. I mean, I think this is right. The people around Obama, to be more specific, that I don't think Obama in some sort of Oliver Stone-like way gets on the phone in the middle of the night and says, you know too much about Vietnam, and then there's a car crash and someone dies. No, that's a guy who doesn't know Washington. What it is that the people around Biden in the highest level, Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Julie Smith, all have made their bones and began their career working for Obama. And so now they've just been promoted again, but they're still at heart Obama acolytes, Obama loyalists. They remember the dream of Obama, the charisma, the speaking, all that. No, they're not. Biden's just the tail end of the Obama adventure for them. But they tend to hew to the views of Obama, particularly, by the way, in the Middle East, where Obama made a big point of saying, we're going to do a deal with the Iranians over nuclear accord, which is a terrible deal, a totally naive deal. It's so Obama, wonderful term paper. You'd give him an A, but it bears no resemblance to the real world whatsoever. And yet again, Obama said, You know, if we can bring them in, then everything will be fine. Yes, if wishes were horses, all beggars would ride, but they don't. And so they're just implementing a policy that began under their mentor. They're now trying to implement it under Biden, who's not putting up much of a fuss, to put it mildly. When Biden makes it through one of his rare press conferences, you can see the visibly relieved staffers take him back as though, thank God we got through the day. How they're going to make it to the election, that's a job I don't want. I don't want to be a Biden PR staffer.
The one I loved was when he staggered to the podium, made his prepared speech really slowly, staggered off, and then came back.
Yeah. I mean, they thought it was done. They thought they were there. And it was Robert Hur, of course, the special counsel, who said, we can't indict him. It's one of the worst arguments ever, but funny, and hit the nail on the head. We can't indict Biden over the missing documents, because even though he's guilty, we could never convict him, because a jury would be sympathetic to such a well-meaning, doddering old fool who can't remember anything. In essence, that's what he said. A well-meaning old man with a poor memory was exactly what they said. And of course, I mean, the logic of this, there is no logic, but he's saying because he's so enfeebled, people would be sympathetic to him. And every alarm bell went off throughout the Democratic establishment. As you say, he makes his speech, they get through it, and then he goes back and then forgets that he's talking about the border of Mexico with the border of Egypt. He confuses presidents as al-Sisi of Egypt with AMLO in Mexico. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And they have to somehow get through an election between now and then without that clear. Because look, I've had parents, we've all had parents, everything's fine until it's not. That there's some good days, there's some bad days. We all know that this is a terrible thing. I don't fault Biden. He's hubristic and he's paying a terrible price for being hubristic. I went to St. Andrews. I have a good classics background, and this is hubris. I fault the people around him who don't tell him it's time to go. Instead, they're so desperate to cling to power that they just hope somehow they can wheel him out without mistake until then. And if this happens, I guarantee there are going to be more problems, as there are with Iran, more problems with China. We don't need a president leaving office in his second term at 86 when we have to deal with a pure superpower competitor in China. We simply, the world is too dangerous for Joe Biden right now.
Holly said a few things earlier on. She said, I think ironically or sarcastically, how modest you sound, said to bit you by your shoes in Milan. But now, see, you've won her over. Totally agrees with your assessment. She says Obama's also running Europe and says, excellent, John. We've only got a couple of minutes left. So let's just look at, we've said what should happen, what will happen. What's your prediction about the, well, I guess I see where you're going with the general, with the presidential election. In terms of Israel and Iran, what's your prediction about what will happen? Because Biden's going to be in the saddle until November, or whoever's managing him will be in the saddle till November, at least.
I think the problem is that America will be, rather than a restraining influence on the war, will be an afterthought. To expect Israel not to retaliate after what just happened to them with 350 missiles is insane. That's, again, otherworldly, naive Wilsonianism. Rather, they should say, of course, Israel has a right to retaliate. You say that publicly. And then privately, you say to the Israelis, now, look, friend, this is what friends say to each other privately at NATO meetings. This is how the U.S. and the U.K. behave all the time. I've been in those meetings that you say, yes, we're with you publicly. But let's remember, we don't want to blow up the entire region. And so pick carefully your targets. Pick Hezbollah. Pick Hamas. Take out Hezbollah generals. Take out Iranian scientists with the Mossad and have no one know that it's you, even though we all know it's you. But have plausible deniability. Attack Hezbollah if they cross lines. Take out their commanders. And indeed, this afternoon, a Hezbollah general who was launching missile attacks on Israel was taken out, just as we're going to air. Do things like that. But don't light off the powder keg, because a regional war doesn't suit you. The other thing to say positively about what happened is the first time in history, something happened that was amazing on this weekend. Saudi Arabia and Jordan quietly joined Israel in shooting down some of these missiles. I've lived to see the Saudis side with Israel Okay, I've lived to see that. Something positive beneath all this is going on. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater and lose that. You want to keep the Saudis and the Jordanians and moderate Arab states on your side. So do strike back. You have to, for the good of your country, for deterrence theory, to prove that you're not living in some other planet with Joe Biden and the Wilsonians, but do it in a measured way so that you can reap the benefit from this without this thing getting totally out of control.
It's a real pleasure to speak with you. I'm definitely going to invite you to my weekend show as well, where we have even a little bit more time than we have. I hope you felt that you've had a fair hearing here. And will you come back?
I certainly will. It was great fun. Let's do it again.
Really enjoying your conversation too. And if I need to buy a pair of shoes, I know who to ask. That's John Hulsman, who is in the most stylish city in Italy and thus in the world, I would say. But my time with you is up. And also with you, dear viewer, thanks very much indeed. I'm standing in again for Mark Morano tomorrow here on Unleashed. Once again, with news and comment, big thank you to the team, Kimberly and co. If you've got views, you can always carry on the chat at tntradio.live, as you have done. Holly, you need a rest. You're doing 7 days a week at the moment, but do keep doing it. Thanks very much indeed to everybody. And I hope that you've learned something about Israel and Iran. And I'm actually optimistic. I think there is a way through, but it might not be with Biden. I'm Len Batopic. This is the Mark Morano Show. This is Unleashed. This is today's News Talk TNT. I'll see you tomorrow.